I call the meeting of the Joint House Environment and Natural Resources Finance and Policy Committee and Senate Climate, Environment, and Legacy Committee to order. Welcome. This is our first joint hearing. There will likely be others. My name is Rick Hansen. I serve as the House Chair. We have a very full schedule today, and I anticipate we will, so we are not going to do introductions of members, but we are going to start to roll right through our presentations. I look forward to working with Chair Herr. He and I have worked together for several years and on LCCMR, so I think there's opportunity where the Senate and the House may agree or may disagree, but we're going to work together as we work our way through that. So I look forward to working with Senator or Chair Herr, and I'm going to hand it over to him just to say a few words as well.
Okay, Chair Herr, thank you all for coming. And my member is still on their way. We have so far one member from the Senate, Senator Nathan Wiesenberger. We'll introduce ourselves later, but we want to start at the get-go and have informational hearing from those that are on the list here. The jurisdiction of my committee is very similar to this committee in addition to legacy. So the counterpart will be the legacy committee and representative or chair Hansen committee. So look forward to many joint committee coming up as well, and we'll conduct our hearing in the Senate and see where we go from there. So glad to have this joint committee together.
And for the folks in the audience or those watching at home and the members, we have had hearings about Emerald Ash Borer, I think, since 2009 when there was the first infestation near Winona, and the first appropriation was actually from the Outdoor Heritage Fund, I believe, in 2009. And there have been various times when there has been money. There have been various times when there's been discussion. There's been various times when there have been research. So the agenda we put forward today as our first joint hearing, we're trying to show the importance of this issue. There are ash trees all over Minnesota, and Minnesota has a lot of ash trees. And Emerald Ash Borer is now, I think there was just an announcement, Watonwan County had an infestation. So this is an issue that reaches all over our state. It is a huge issue, and I think you're going to hear today, and across as many jurisdictions, from the agencies, but also to how do we deal with the trees, replanting the trees, and ultimately disposing of the trees. So this is a flavor I think you're going to get today of the immense challenges we have with Emerald Ash Borer facing Minnesotans. So first up, we have the Minnesota Department of Natural Resources, the Minnesota Department of Agriculture, and the Minnesota Pollution Control Agency. If they would come forward and introduce themselves for the record.
Is this your first one, or do you have a committee?
Is this your third one? Labor education policy.
And members, we'll try to take questions after each block of presentations, because you're going to hear a lot of presentations. So we'll have the agencies first and then the Shade Tree Advisory. So if members have questions after this section with the agencies, then we'll take those questions. So, Mr. Abramson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Mark Abrahamson. I'm the Director of Plant Protection at the Department of Agriculture.
My name is Valerie McClanahan, and I am the Urban and Community Forestry Coordinator at the Department of Natural Resources.
So I'm just going to give a very brief introduction to what the Department of Agriculture's role is with Emerald Ash Borer. So Department of Agriculture is kind of like the first responders with invasive pests like Emerald Ash Borer. So we're the ones who do the detection work. We're the ones who confirm new infestations. And so we've been tracking Emerald Ash Borer across Minnesota. You see the map there. That's the current distribution available on our web map. And Watonwan County just announced its quarantine. Emerald Ash Borer has been spreading fairly quickly across other Minnesota, a little bit more slowly across northern Minnesota. Along with detection and confirmation, we also have authority to regulate the movement of products that could move Emerald Ash 4. So you see on that map, the red lines, those are the quarantine boundaries of where Emerald Ash 4 is known to be present, and we're limiting the movement of materials that can come out of those areas that could spread Emerald Ash 4 to new places. Along with that work, we also have done a lot of technical assistance related to Emerald Ash 4. So we've done a lot of work focusing on communities. Communities are important as tending to be the first places where Emerald Ash 4 is found, moving with people, and then also being places that it's easy to be moved out of. So we've worked a lot with cities. As the number of cities has grown, our time we spend with them gets to be less. So we tend to, as Emerald Ash 4 shows up a new city, we spend time getting up to speed, but then pass them on to work with the DNR in terms of community forestry. And then lastly, I'll just mention that biological control or using other insects control Emerald Ash 4. That's something Department of Agriculture has been responsible for. So it's not a silver bullet, but it's one of the tools in the toolbox that we use to help manage the pest. And I'm going to turn it over to Val at the DNR.
All right. Welcome.
I'm going to move over here. Hi, good afternoon, everybody. So I'm Valerie McClanahan from the Department of Natural Resources. Like I said, I'm the Urban and Community Forestry Coordinator there, and I'm going to talk about Emerald Ash 4's impacts on Minnesota's forests. So I want to start first by talking about where ash is in the state. If you look at the map, you'll see the shaded area represents our ash forest spaces, and then the dots show the percent in our community forests. So as of 2010, 20% of our community forests were ash. So one of every five trees at that time was an ash tree. So left untreated, all ash trees will die. It's over 99% of ash that are infested end up dying. That has some really huge climate change impacts, as you can imagine. If you look at just our community ash, if the loss of those trees, or if we lose all of those trees, we're looking at losing 7.8 million pounds of atmospheric carbon and 2.96 billion gallons of stormwater capacity. So ultimately, these trees and the loss of these trees will increase salt and sediment into some already struggling water systems that we have. With that, that clearly widens the gaps around greenhouse gas emissions. And then when you expand that out, because those numbers are just from our urban and community forests to our 1 billion ash trees throughout the entire state of Minnesota, we're looking at some pretty astronomical impacts. So communities are at the greatest risk right now and the greatest immediate need of our support. Helping communities now helps slow the spread of EAB to other cities as well as to our ash forests. Cities continue to tell us that they need support in inventories so that they know where ash are located, their size. They also need management plans, and they need funding to actually implement those management plans to treat, remove, and then replant their trees with climate adaptive species. They also need help educating their residents, and they need to be able to directly support their homeowners. So if communities don't have the needed financial or technical assistance, they'll have a community full of standing dead ash trees. Ultimately, we do work with professionals to provide technical assistance to municipalities and counties, but additional financial support is needed to help communities respond to this issue. So when we talk about standing dead ash, I'm going to quote Dr. John Ball, that standing ash or infested ash have the structural integrity of a standing potato chip. Ultimately, what happens is the larvae eat at the cambial layer, which ends up dehydrating the tree, leaving it brittle and ultimately a liability in the landscape. So not only are they unsafe to the general public, but without added training, tree care professionals are at a higher risk of injury in infested ash, as they do have a tendency to shatter. So we've been working to increase financial assistance for communities to manage their ash proactively so that they don't become a hazard in the landscape. As of now, all available funding has been dedicated to public trees. So funding is really needed so that communities can assist their residents. Removals on residential property, we're hearing, is costing anywhere between $1,000 to $6,000 or more, depending on the size and location. That cost absolutely goes up if the tree is infested, as different equipment is often needed in order to remove the tree safely. So ultimately, this becomes not just an environmental or public safety issue, but definitely an issue of equity. So this is the best part. I get to thank you for your previous support in supporting communities throughout the state. There's so much work that would not have been able to get done without the funding assistance that you've provided. Currently, we have grants with 112 communities, 112 open contracts with communities. These have been focused around Emerald Ash Borer and ash management, and have consistently funded tree inventories, management plans, tree removal, and tree planting on public land. So as of fiscal year 2022 and 2023, we had $1.7 million available in funding. However, that funding does drop in fiscal year 2024 to $400,000 available annually, dedicated to help communities manage their ash. So despite recent funding that communities are so incredibly grateful for, I wish I could share that out with you, the thanks that I'm getting, because that's really in due to so much of the work that you've done. But since 2019, our state-funded programs totaling $7.8 million in funding have received $14.5 million in requested funds. So we've only been able to award 56% of the applications that we've received. So going beyond those that have applied, we've heard from some communities that just haven't applied at all because they're worried about the limited amount of funds. But I want to also add that the maximum dollar amount for these grants has been anywhere between $30,000 to $150,000. And I want to say that because we believe that the need is significantly higher than that. Many communities need large amounts of ongoing support, as ash is often the predominant species in their community, and their staff capacity might be low, meaning that all of the work that needs to get done can't actually get done in a single grant cycle. So I want to also add, I think this is in your packets, but the Environmental Quality Board EAB report did recommend $8.5 million a year until 2030 in community support to develop and implement ash management plans, provide education and technical assistance to professionals and to homeowners. So we're going to move into our traditional forested spaces. Minnesota is in a unique situation. We have more ash than any other state. 1 billion trees spread out among 1 million acres, of which DNR manages 170,000 acres. Ash is the second most predominant tree in our state. So we can learn some things from Michigan, Wisconsin, and New England, but we are in uncharted territory. In the southern part of Minnesota, you're gonna see green ash in upland sites or in communities, not the black ash swamps that call northern Minnesota home. This is where we'll find most of our 1 billion ash. It is in these ash swamps that present a very big future challenge. Ash forests in Minnesota have a higher rate of ash than what we see in neighboring states like Michigan. So in Michigan, it's more likely to be a component of a mixed hardwood forest, while Minnesota, our ash-dominated forests are ash-dominated. So some of our key management goals for this is to keep forests forests. This is tricky as ash is a dominant species in wet, swampy environments, as it has a unique ability to serve as a water pump and regulate water levels. We also want to maintain hydrology. If trees aren't able to absorb the water in these wetland sites, unused water will run off to other parts of the landscape. We also want to be minimizing habitat and biodiversity loss. Foresters are planning to support the unique collection of plants and wildlife that are in these ash swamps. But I will say reforestation does present some challenges because it's a very wet space. So based on research and recent experience, we are discovering species that will survive as replacements. And they're pretty promising. We know that reforestation ultimately is necessary as a means of preventing invasive plants from establishing. So harvesting is a tool that we use in order to open up spaces for the forest to allow for new tree species to grow and establish. But there are some challenges here as well to ensure that there are markets that support the harvest so that these trees are going to good use. But then also the actual harvest itself is a limiting factor, as pure ash stands usually are more difficult to freeze, which is necessary in order to get the equipment on site to do the harvesting. Ultimately, what it means is they take more work and they are more expensive for a relatively lower demand species. So there are existing markets. Energy right now is the main option for urban ash at this time, although we really do hope to see that expand. Firewood, pallet and paper markets exist for ash, and some logs or veneer and solid wood products like flooring. Ash has not historically had a consistent pulpwood market, but we've seen several mills have increased their use in recent years. And we do use ash in a few different industry sectors, but not enough yet for the sheer amount that we could potentially be harvesting. Ultimately, it has been 14 years since EAB was discovered in Minnesota. We know a lot more about EAB and how it interacts in Minnesota's forests. And we know that the biggest EAB impacts are yet to come. Many partners are ultimately needed to make this successful. And no one agency can really do this alone. Looking ahead, we are looking to continue our collaborative efforts with our state agencies, but also with tribes, cities, counties, private woodland groups, industry, researchers, because ultimately the goal is to continue slowing the spread. That will allow our costs to be absorbed more slowly and the impacts absorbed more slowly over time. And then ultimately, we also think that community assistance is critical to slowing the spread, since that is the main location where they're located, or where EAB is found. Ash use and waste solutions are needed to help maintain ecosystem and our carbon sequestration benefits. So with that, I'm going to hand you off to Dave Benke from the Minnesota Pollution Control Agency.
Mr. Benke, if you could introduce yourself for the record.
Thank you, Chairs, members of the Joint Committee. My name is David Benke. I'm the Director of the Resource Management Assistance Division at the Minnesota Pollution Control Agency. I appreciate the opportunity to give you a quick update on the activities that the agency has been taking, especially as it relates to wood waste and that affected by the emerald ash borer. Next slide. As we look ahead, we know that the amount of wood waste is going to increase, and we've already seen that, and it continues to build. We want to see that the trees are managed in a way that gets the highest, best use out of those trees. Trees weren't harvested to throw away. There's good value in those, and so we want to make sure that they can go to trees, into products or be used to their highest use. Best way would be to prevent them from, especially in the urban area, from coming off the landscape. They provide the environmental benefits that Valerie mentioned in terms of stormwater, air, and heating and cooling benefits as well. And so those trees serving that purpose is really the highest and best use. So keeping them on the landscape is the goal. But when they do have to come down, let's make them into products. And as you can see on that hierarchy, it also includes, composting those, getting biomass from getting the trees into biomass so they can create energy. And last, if need be, may have to look at, disposal of those trees. Open burning is certainly something we want to try and avoid because of the pollution impacts of that. So if you look at the next slide, you can see the options for managing EAB-infested wood that currently are here in the state. If the trees are brought down, the valuable resources that we can get from those, as Valerie mentioned, are timber harvesting. But for the urban forests, it's not as likely to happen. That harvesting is more suitable for the larger tracts, but some urban wood recovery is possible and is taking place, and we need to encourage that. For wood products like manufactured wood and paper and so forth, again, the urban forests are a little harder to get that for. So we look at mulching or composting as one of the larger sources, getting the material to a yard waste site where they can be chipped and or shredded down to appropriate size. And then the mulch is used for landscape projects throughout. That can be dyed or colored or all kinds of things in order to enhance the landscapes and used that way. Biochar is something new that's coming on, and we've seen that develop a little bit, and that might also promise additional capacity. We've utilized biomass in terms of recovery of energy for heating, and that's a large portion of what we relied on for disposal. We're also looking at, you know, utilization of it for recreational fires. And for the agency, we want to make sure that if it does get used for that, we get it dried, split, and properly stored to, again, reduce the emissions from those backyard recreational fires. But I think the importance is that we need to expand the markets for every ton of capacity that we currently have. We probably need to increase that in order to manage what we see coming. The next slide kind of updates on what the agency's doing and its ongoing activities. We're coordinating with the metro counties in particular to include wood waste management for EAB in the next round of solid waste policy plans. The state develops the metro solid waste policy plan every 6 years. Counties then implement plans underneath that. We're monitoring the innovative and development markets for wood waste, including, you know, as I mentioned, increased use in the urban use of the wood, biochar, and we want to make sure we're supporting the existing wood waste management infrastructure with the composting facilities and the biomass facilities. We recognize that we got to coordinate this with the other agencies and make sure that we've got good understanding of what everyone's trying to do in order to make sure we have a good, solid effort across. The last slide I think I can share for everyone from the presentations in front of me is that we need to strengthen that statewide coordinated effort to slow the spread and delay the cost. We need to provide the financial and technical assistance to the communities to deal with it. We need to develop markets for making products from ash and end-of-life management. But those markets will be there for the next disease, you know, tree problem that we have, and the ongoing need for tree management from storms and from just general aging of the forests in the urban areas. And last, we need to develop a statewide approach to utilize the ash and for disposal of the ash waste. So thanks for the time, and we're here for any questions that you might have.
Thank you. And members, we have about 10 minutes for questions. I want to start with Mr. Abramson on the biology of the bug. So just how resilient is it, you know, and when we're talking about moving or processing or repurposing, what do we have to do for the bug to be dead? And then how long can it live? Some of those very basic biology questions.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Yeah, so the emerald ash borer is a wood borer, so it, as a larva, it's beneath the bark and it's protected there. So it's just within an inch of the outer bark, so it never tunnels deeply into the wood. So when we think about a piece of wood that's infested, it's really the outer inch that we need to be concerned about. So when we're talking about products, if we can just get it milled, so we're removing that outer inch, the rest of the wood is can be then used to make boards or whatever. That part that is infested has to be chipped up or burned to destroy the insect. And so research out of Michigan, where emerald ash borer has been the longest, it's found that you need to get wood chips down to an inch in two dimensions in order to kill the larvae and not have them emerge, which is typically sometimes could be done with a chipper, but often needs to go through a tub grinder to get material down to that size. The insect itself can live up to about 2 years within material, so you can't remove a tree during the summer when the adults are flying around and think that there aren't any bugs in it, because with that two-year life cycle, 1 to 2 years, there's never a time when there aren't insects in the tree, so there's not really a safe time to not have them in there. We usually recommend that management work is done during the dormant period when they're present as a larva in the tree but not as the adult beetle, so that would be October through April. And the reasoning for that is that if you need to truck that material somewhere to get it processed, and if you do that during the summer, that potentially have beetles emerging in route to that site. In the winter, that doesn't happen. So as you get to a point where there are lots and lots and lots of infested trees, that doesn't matter so much anymore. So that would be more of a, something we'd recommend to a place that's relatively new in the infestation. We're trying to keep it as limited as possible. Thank you, everything, Mr. Chair.
Just a quick follow-up to DNR. If we provided early funding, considering the April deadline, would you be able to get grants out to communities to work on management?
You know, typically how that would end up navigating is we would have that request for proposals process, and then, you know, where we can focus, where the work is needed most. And then they have to ultimately be contracting out that work potentially. So they're having to develop bid processes and mark the trees. So, I mean, we would be able to get that money spent, absolutely. They would not necessarily be able to immediately start removing trees this year, given the curve, like where we're at. But, you know, potentially, if we're saying October, December, November, I think November, December seems like we would actually be able to get something done within the year from now. Absolutely.
I've started a list. So Representative Jordan and Representative Finke and then Representative Heinzman. Make sure if you want to get on the list, let me make sure I see you. Representative Jordan.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I believe my question is also for Director Abramson and Coordinator McClanahan. My question is how do quarantines work? I think that's an interesting word, given that bugs don't really care if we say don't go outside of this county line. So how does that work? What goes into it? And what sort of resources are required for enforcing and maintaining a quarantine? Very intrigued by that.
Mr. Abramson.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. Yeah, so a quarantine, or we think about it as you know, regulations, but basically what we're doing is we're making a list of things that shouldn't leave that area because they could carry Emerald Ash Borer with it, and we do that for other things as well. So for Emerald Ash Borer, that would be any kind of ash material that hasn't been processed yet. So it could be chips that aren't chipped up fine enough, or trees or boards or whatever, and also firewood. Firewood is always is a really difficult one because firewood, we just restrict as firewood. We don't restrict just ash firewood because it oftentimes is mixed together. That is really the part that makes it difficult to enforce this quarantine, because anybody can move firewood, and so we can't regulate the general public. We do a good job working with industry and have had good success working with industry to limit the movement of products, but for the general public, we're really limited to outreach campaigns and making sure that people are getting the messaging about firewood.
Representative Finke.
Thank you, Chair, and thank you all for your presentation today. I'm very excited to work with you on all of this. Representative Finke is my name, and for those future conversations, my pronouns are she, her. And I just wanted to ask a clarifying question for myself. You were talking about the trees, essentially community trees versus forest trees. So those are two options. Anything that's not forest is community. Would that be correct?
You know, typically when I'm sorry.
Go ahead.
Okay. I'm still new at this. Thank you, Representative. thank you so much for the question, Chair, Representative Finke. You know, I work with residents, I work with cities, I work with counties, and then there's, you know, it's all based on that jurisdictional state land. So I would say, I mean, we do cover the state, it's just in varying capacities, right? So mm-hmm. DNR, also Division of Forestry, covers state land in our forested areas. We also have cooperative forest management foresters who assist on private land. Those are typically programs that are 20 acres or greater, but they work outside of, you know, city boundaries. And then I come in for, you know, we will assist cities on in their natural land spaces. Right now, the way that our grants have navigated, the priority has been on public safety, really, we're going to have to start transitioning to protecting some of those natural spaces as well. So yeah, we cover all of the ground.
Yeah. So I guess the question, one of the questions I would like to have answered, and it doesn't have to be by you or right now, but if one out of five trees in the state of Minnesota are ash trees, is that true of Minneapolis and St. Paul as well, and the metro area as a whole?
Thank you, Chair and Representative. Yeah, so at one point, so each, that's definitely an average throughout the state of communities. Back in 2010, we had done a statistical sampling of 700 communities throughout the state of Minnesota. At this point in time, Minneapolis, I would say, no longer likely has that many ash trees in their public right-of-ways because they've been very aggressive in that. St. Paul, very similarly, I would say that they're probably no longer in that place. You know, when we start to look at private property, that's an entirely different set of questions that we maybe don't have the data on at this point in time.
Representative Heitzen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I've heard a couple of comments over the course of the discussion today and presentation, which thank you. I appreciate your taking the time to come and visit with us about this issue. But the comment specifically that I wanted to address is management, and I wouldn't want there to be any misunderstanding. It looks like there may be one slide where there's a mention of treatment, and that's a brief discussion, but in most cases, if not all, unless I'm mistaken, we're talking about removal of the tree. It might help to expand on that a little bit if there is any misunderstanding, if I've misunderstood, in other words.
Thank you so much for that question. Yeah, and so we have had grants over time that have not allowed for treatment. We do have one currently that has allowed for treatment of using non-neonicotinoid insecticide. So we've been using something called emamectin benzoate. Essentially, it just has to be an injectable non-neonicotinoid insecticide. So it's a point source. It's going straight into the tree and not into the soil surrounding it. And there's only one grant that we've had available so far that has funded treatment. So the rest, it has been a remove and replace. So we have required a replacement of 1-to-1, but we are encouraging a 2-to-1 if communities have the capacity to do so.
Representative Heitzen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. If you could maybe further explain some of the success, if there is any. Do we have any data? Do we see 90% of those trees treated, restored? And is that a good investment, or should we be focusing just on the removal and the process after that?
Thank you so much for that question. Chair, Representative, you know, I don't recommend treatment in all cases, but it is very successful. You know, there are requirements for as to when you would end up treating the tree. They look at how much damage has taken place. So if it is a tree that has a significant amount of, it's just highly infested, there's a lot of damage, you're seeing a lot of canopy loss in it, we wouldn't recommend that you end up treating that tree. That is likely a good case for removal. However, some trees are worth treating, I would say. You want to be specific about what that looks like, but sometimes that one ash tree is the only large tree that provides shade for blocks and blocks, and so sometimes having that option is really important. Ultimately, communities are the ones who we encourage to make those decisions as to what's going to be right for them. I think sometimes treating that tree is a great option, and sometimes it does need to be removed. So we do provide guidance, but we leave it into the hands of the communities to make some of those decisions.
And just to be clear, and I've got a list over here to Representative Heitzen, I think we need to do both. We're at a point now with a crisis where we're gonna have to deal with treatment and removal.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My final question would simply be, it'd be nice to have some numbers to know exactly what we're talking about. This is taxpayer investment into potentially saving a tree, and if the success rate is very low, then I think that should be considered. So hopefully that's some information we could have at a later time.
Senator Herr.
Yes, we have a question over here from Senator Morrison.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you for the presentation. I had a couple of questions, and several have already been answered. I'm wondering, I'm old enough to remember the Dutch elm disease crisis, dating myself a little bit here. But I'm wondering if you could give us a comparison. This strikes me as an overwhelmingly large problem. And I'm wondering if there is a way to compare this crisis to that for all of us.
Ms. McClain.
Thank you, Chairs and Senator. Yeah, so during Dutch elm disease, we were looking at something to the extent of 70% of the trees in Minnesota's communities were elms. And right now, I mean, we clearly have learned a lesson. We're looking at closer to 20%. So it's not that we didn't learn anything, but there are a significant number of differences when we're looking at just the structural integrity. Elms, as it appears, have enough structural integrity to stand for years and years without, you know, they kind of just slowly fall apart. But ash are a totally different story. And so that's where some of my concerns end up coming into play around that public safety component because, you know, a lot of climbers that I know, they're comfortable climbing dead elms, but they're going to use other equipment when they're looking at, you know, significant damage to an ash tree.
Senator Morrison.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you for that answer and that the danger to the people removing the infected trees is an additional component. And so I'm kind of following up on Representative Heinzman's questions in terms of figuring out what best practices are. How do you make the decision at what point, what's the tipping point when you identify an infected tree? I hear that you're leaving it up to the communities, but it seems that obviously you're taking the surrounding area, how many other ash trees are right next to it, but kind of what are best practices for figuring out when you treat and when you remove?
Yeah. Thank you so much, chairs and senator. You know, there are a few different factors when we're looking at would make a recommendation for treatment versus removal. I think, you know, the first thing we look at is canopy loss. You know, we would never recommend treatment of a tree that has more than 50% loss of their canopy that we know is infested. The other part of that is, you know, is it a single ash in a park with, you know, 30 to 100 other gorgeous looking full-size trees? You know, maybe you can afford to lose that one, but if it is the only one on the block, you know, maybe that's one that you end up treating. So, you know, there is that threshold when they're looking at canopy cover. And that's how they're starting to analyze it. But the research for that and the safety component of it, you know, there are some studies testing tensile strength of infested ash trees, but they're still in process of figuring out, you know, the rate of infestation within the tree and what that ends up meaning for the ash itself. Have I answered that question?
Yeah, any follow-up?
Thank you for that context. No, this is a very sobering presentation. Thank you.
And Senator Wisenberg?
Thank you, Chair. This is for Valerie McLennan. Could you provide, so you have some background on me, I'm a wildlife biologist, and I've worked for the Minnesota Department of Natural Resources in the past, and I still do contract work with the DNR. Could you provide me with data? You mentioned some climate change stuff. Do you have that data?
Yeah. Are you talking about the atmospheric carbon numbers in the stormwater gallons?
I don't know. Just at the beginning of your presentation, you said you mentioned that ash trees are dying and has a climate change impact. I would just like to see that data.
Yeah.
And another question, could you describe to me how removing trees is an issue of equity? When I went through school, I don't remember having that as equity as biology. I don't think we should be putting those together.
Yep, Ms. McClanahan still trying to struggle. Three syllable last name here, but go ahead.
Thank you, Senator Herr. And thank you, Senator. Yes, we can absolutely get you the data that we have around it's what we've compiled using the U.S. Forest Service's iTree programs and their analysis. So I'm definitely happy to get that to you. And then the equity components really come into play. You know, it doesn't matter, you know, whether you're living in Minneapolis or in Bemidji. If there's a tree that is falling apart and becomes a public safety issue that you can't afford, that's where that equity piece comes in. So we have been working to partner with Habitat for Humanity in the Twin Cities and actually in Bemidji around trying to provide some sort of assistance for homeowners, but we've been able to get some federal dollars to assist.
Right, and I understand that part, so it's good. I mean, we need to take care of trees in communities. I just want to make sure we're not going way into that, making it sound like trees are racist or something. That's what I'm getting at with the equity thing.
Sure. So, yeah.
Right. So, and then this is for the, oh, also,
Senator Wiesma, if you, can you hold on for
you?
Each question?
Oh, I'm sorry.
Before? Yeah.
Should I address you or? Okay. Yes. So if I could address the chair, I'm just wondering, are we, I'm guessing when the trees get brittle, then we have to come into the booms rather than just climbing. Is that what's happening?
Yep. Ms. McClanahan.
Thank you, Senator and Chair and Senator. What is typical is, sometimes you'll do, if they can't climb it, they'll have a bucket truck.
Yep.
If you can't access it with a bucket truck, that is especially the case when it's in a small backyard where homes are tighter together and you can't get in that, you don't have access. That's where a crane comes in.
Costly, yeah.
And that's when we start looking at astronomical cost. I mean, I think you'll hear from some folks later about some of the costs that it can get up to. Yeah.
Yep.
And not that we're going to have to wrap it up this section.
Okay.
Due to time, because we also
sorry,
have
Peter.
Two other groups that are going to follow and talk about Ammo Ashford as well. And perhaps because we're kind of quiet over here on the side, and I see Senator Green raise his hand. Let's go greet, and then Representative Fu Lee also have a question. So after Representative Fu Lee's done, then we'll just move on to the next section. You know, appreciate your presentation. So Senator Green.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and to the testifiers. It's just a quick question, something that I was thinking of when you were talking about treatment. Have you explored any maybe natural treatments that would go to the ash trees before they were infested? I mean, because we kill bugs by accident. All right, so there's got to be something out there we would believe that that might work. So have you done any testing on that?
Ms. McConaughey?
I think, Mr. Chair. So I think probably biocontrol is would be the best answer for that one. So that is, where insects evolve, they have enemies. And so in Asia, where emerald ash borer comes from, there are other bugs that prey on them. And so USDA has done that work of evaluating those insects. They've brought them here. They're safe to have in our environment. And so that's something that we have been working on, getting them established in Minnesota and exactly to the point to try to control the population naturally. It does not do it on its own, but it is like another tool in the toolbox to help manage the numbers.
And then, do you mind if I ask? Thank you, Senator and Senator. We do recommend being proactive. We don't necessarily recommend treating all of your trees if you are really far away from a known infestation, but you can absolutely be treating them proactively in order to prevent EAB from impacting those trees.
Thank you for the response. Now, Representative Fooley, and then after that, we'll wrap up, go to the next section.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you presenter for bringing the issue of equity. I think that it's really important for communities like mine in North Minneapolis, where, you know, during the summer months, the trees provide shades and really help with the issues around energy use during those hot days, and also improving air quality. So really appreciate that point. Mr. Chair, and for the testifiers, probably MPCA. So I understand that, you know, under the Federal Clean Water State Revolving Fund, there's an allowable use for green infrastructure. And when I think the testifier from the DNR was talking about stormwater protection, have there been any consideration around using the State Clean Water Revolving Fund as a funding source for us to plant trees as we move forward as a state?
Thank you. Mr. Chair, members, I hadn't looked at that for the possibility of funding source, and we'll take that back and take a harder look at that. I know that the green infrastructure has been part of our work on stormwater issues and using trees, hasn't been necessarily looked at that, but that's a good suggestion.
Ms. Zumach and Mr. Johnson would come forward. We're going to move to the next section. We're trying to make sure we give everybody an opportunity to ask questions, and if the presenters are prompt. We might be able to squeeze a few more in. We have, just to foreshadow a little bit, we have the presentation from the Shade Tree Advisory Committee, EAB research from the University of Minnesota, so some of the research questions, and then wood waste, district energy, and Xcel Energy. So we're going to try to take it through the whole life cycle here, and if the presenters would state their name for the record, and welcome.
Thank you, Chair Hansen, Chair Herv, and members of the committees. My name is Craig Johnson. I am with the League of Minnesota Cities and am one of the members of the Minnesota Shade Tree Advisory Council. And Karen Zumach is here as well.
Hello, my name is Karen Zumach. I am the current president of the Minnesota Shade Tree Advisory Committee.
So, Mr. Chair, I'm going to go first just with a brief kind of overview of things and let our tree expert follow up with what we really have going on out there on the ground. So obviously Minnesota cities are significantly affected by this. You heard that in the testimony from the agencies. It's the core of where this is developing because it's where there's a concentration of ash trees for this pest to spread. So emerald ash borer, like other forest pest issues before, often starts in urban forests. And that's what we've seen in this case, and it is rapidly spreading across the state, coming soon to a city near you if it's not there yet. And we are all working desperately to try and slow that to the maximum extent practicable. But that takes a lot of work and a lot of money, and it's work that is not in a normal city budget at this time. We do need to look for where we're going to be able to build the capacity to deal with this. We need to have local capacity, as we heard, for even the inventorying aspects. So we do have cities, for instance, with more than 50% of the trees that have been inventoried in their city as ash trees. Those cities are going to be decimated when an emerald ash borer gets there because all of those ashes will die. And we do have cities that have lower percentages, but most cities in Minnesota have pretty high percentages because when all the elm trees died, we replaced them heavily with green ash. And so we created this next new situation that we're dealing with. Urban forest folks are now trying to remedy that by having more diverse plantings. Karen can talk about that when her turn comes up. But we do still have cities that have not even had the resources yet to do the inventories to determine what their problems are. And we have the ongoing issue of identifying where there are infected trees that need to be dealt with. And as you heard mentioned, cities have been able to get some resources in particular to deal with public trees. So that means on public boulevards, in public parks, on public land. There are really virtually no resources available for if that happens on your private property. And that is where some of the equity issues start to show. I was able to have a cherry picker come in and deal with a 5-cluster of ash trees in my yard last summer that was infected. It was removed, but it was expensive. And if I did not have the resources to do that, I would have just had to wait and try and figure out how to handle that on my own as chunks started to fall out of it, which they were about to start doing. So we do have a pretty urgent situation in terms of needing to remove that, and you will be hearing from cities about it. The costs involve the studies necessary to identify what the tree populations are and where vulnerable trees are, identifying which trees are already weak or infected, and then targeting those based on their health for either treatment or removal and replacement, because we do need to get the canopy replaced. Losing tree canopy is a very significant issue in an urban forest setting. It, on a homeowner basis, can have a pretty significant effect on heating and cooling costs, and it can also have a significant impact on stormwater. A single large tree canopy, mature tree canopy, can prevent up to an inch of rainwater from reaching the ground by suspending it on the leaves, and then it transevaporates from there rather than becoming a stormwater issue. So really does make a big difference in an urban setting, and we need more trees, not less, but that's not the direction our tree canopies are going right now. So I'll let Karen tell you what we need to do about that. Thank you.
All right, Ms. Zuman, go ahead.
Thank you. My name is, as I said, Karen Zumach. I'm the president of the Minnesota Shade Tree Advisory Committee. If you aren't familiar with what that is, we are a 500-plus member organization that is tasked with advising the DNR on urban forestry-related topics. Our mission is to be the leading advocate for Minnesota's community forests. and to empower and educate Minnesota's citizens to maximize the coverage, health, quality, function, and future of our community forests. Our board is represented by many state agencies, the Minnesota Nursery and Landscape Association, the League of Minnesota Cities, at-large members, utility arborists, to name a few. Thank you, Chairs Herr and Hansen, for convening this critically important informational hearing for members on the topic of Emerald Ash Borer that seems like we've been talking about forever. I'd also like to thank the previous members of both committees today for their support to date in assisting in managing EAB. It's important to reiterate that the financial and environmental chaos caused by Emerald Ash Borer is not over. Many may argue it is only just the beginning, especially as aggressive action is needed to address the climate crisis, the state's ability to manage wood waste becomes more limited, tree removal costs are increasing as more and more trees die due to EAB, and city budgets are squeezed with the overwhelming costs associated with the urgency of removing infested ash trees on public property. So let's just take a step back as the agencies talked about earlier, just to make sure that we're understanding the gravity of the loss of trees at this magnitude. Minnesota is home to the largest population of ash trees of anywhere in the nation. We're number one. And as such, we have the most to lose. Just yesterday, the 38th county was confirmed with EAB. While the efforts to date have been appreciated, we are now at a point where significant investment must be made and sustained to assist communities with this issue. Many of you may recall the loss of significant loss of ash of trees in the 1970s during the Dutch elm disease pandemic. The 1977 legislature passed a bill that was then signed into law by Governor Anderson allocating $26 million for 2 years to address the issues around managing emerald ash borer. It is that kind of investment that is needed today. If we were just to adjust for inflation, according to the Minneapolis Fed, that would be an investment of $125 million for urban and community forestry for 2 years. It's time to make EAB management a priority. Active management of EAB requires technical assistance, removal, replanting, and preserving of those high-quality ash trees in order to transition away from the over-reliance of ash in our urban forests. Active and aggressive management is critically important in order to buy more time to keep EAB out of where it isn't, those critical black ash stands of northern Minnesota. It's important so the science can have the time to catch up and develop an ability to preserve that critical resource. Moreover, more and more trees are dying on private property, creating a significant financial burden for property owners as they are in many communities mandated to remove infested trees, which oftentimes results in additional multi-year tax assessments for those who cannot shoulder the many $1,000 upfront cost to have the tree removed. One city provided a $22,000 bid to a homeowner for a tree removal through the assessment process. Imagine having to shoulder a $20,000 tree removal cost as a person on a fixed income. I'm quite certain that there are more stories just like this across the state, and I would encourage you to inquire with your communities about the impacts of EAB to private property owners. Now take a look at the picture of these ash trees standing along this street, and imagine it's in one of your communities that you represent. A single ash tree just standing there, of course, if it's healthy and not infested, provides about $150 in benefits each year to the adjacent property owner. This comes in terms of increased property values, carbon sequestration, carbon stormwater mitigation, and cooling and shading benefits. Moreover, our entire community benefits with cleaner air and improved water quality, just to name a few of those benefits. And even better yet, those benefits will only increase in time, just like fine wine, as the tree grows larger. Now consider a city with 2,000 or 5,000 or 10,000 ash trees, all providing those benefits at a much larger scale. The impacts of their loss are significant. This picture here is just one Minnesota community, one neighborhood in one Minnesota community. Each of those red dots represents an ash tree. Now take a look at what we lose. hopefully this isn't lost on the video, but this is a side-by-side video or side-by-side photograph shot through Google Earth showing the same two areas of Minneapolis, with the only difference being that the one on the left is 2008 and the one on the right is 2022. The one on the left is the one ahead of the invasion of Emerald Ash Borer. You'll see on the right there's considerably less tree canopy cover, and that is the result of what some might call the most aggressive management strategy of removal and replanting, where 40,000 trees were removed over 8 years. 40,000 trees worth of benefits removed. Now, I can't do anything about the quality of these photos, but hopefully it's not lost on the fact that these are two side-by-side pictures of 2011 in Milwaukee before EAB was identified, and then again in 2022. You hopefully can see that that tree canopy cover is about the same, and that's because Milwaukee decided to invest in treating a large percentage of their ash trees. They use the injectable non-neonicotinoid pesticide, and those benefits that were discussed previously have been and will continue to be preserved. And there's little difference between that pre-invasion and post-invasion tree canopy. Research has shown that it takes three generations to restore a tree canopy devastated by an invasive species to the pre-invasion levels. The now retired scientist from the U.S. Forest Service, Dave Nowak, has been quoted as saying that trees in urban areas reduce air temperatures, shade surfaces, and consequently alter building energy use. On a per-tree basis, urban trees offer the greatest potential to reduce climate change, as not only do they sequester carbon, but they also can provide a permanent reduction in greenhouse gas emissions through reduced energy use. Additionally, trees grown in the urban environment have the ability to capture and store four times as much carbon as those grown in traditional forested areas. But there's one caveat. They must not only survive in the harsh urban environment, but they must also thrive. And to thrive, these trees need investment from us. So MNSAC requests that the state make emerald ash borer management a priority. We ask that you provide assistance in the form of matching grants to cities and towns to allow to access to all the tools necessary to mitigate the effects of EAB, including expedited removal, replanting as feasible with funding for young tree establishment. That means funding for watering, because a new tree can't live without several years of water. Preservation of high quality ash trees and private ash tree removal cost abatement of at least $8.5 million a year, which was recommended in the Minnesota EQB EAB report. And this is requested for the next 20 years. Also, to include funding to support a carbon crediting program to incentivize the preservation of ash trees in order to attain our climate change goals. Support sustained urban and community forestry funding, which must include funding for maintenance to create a more resilient urban and community forest for the future, a key component of Minnesota Climate Action Framework, at least $22 million a year. Support research efforts to protect the ecologically significant northern black ash stands. We must aggressively support the work being done to ensure the preservation of this important resource. And lastly, incentivize and mandate urban wood utilization in order to walk the talk on climate goals. While we understand and support an allocation of state funding to assist St. Paul Cogen to continue to play as a major role in wood waste management, we propose that any funding provided to St. Paul Cogen to continue managing our state's wood waste issue must also be matched with funding to support wood utilization efforts. We must do better to prepare for the next urban forest pest, and building the critical infrastructure to attain a robust urban wood utilization market will ensure the highest and best use for this waste stream. I thank you for your time and attention, and I'm happy to answer any questions.
Thank you, Ms. Zumek and Mr. Johnson. We have a question here from Senator Kunesh, and maybe we can take a few more, one or two questions. We're not going to be strict with time, but we're passing 10 minutes of time, too. So go ahead, Senator Kunesh.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Ms. Zumek. Those 40,000 trees that were removed, could you tell us who was responsible for removing that? Was it the residents? Was it the city? Who removed them, and at what cost?
Thank you, Senator Herr. Thank you, Senator Kunesh. So this is the Minneapolis Park and Recreation Board that is responsible for public trees in Minneapolis. They are a taxing entity, so they were able to generate funding for the Emerald Ash Borer Management Plan. While I do not have that number, I can certainly supply you with the total dollar amount, or perhaps you might know. But it was completely done in-house. The Minneapolis Park and Recreation Board is also estimating right now there are about 30,000 trees on private property in Minneapolis.
Yes, Senator Kuna.
One more question. So the trees that were removed, are they all reusable? I mean, can you plank them out? Can you use them? Just strip out the outside, but is there a problem with, like, releasing those emerald ash critters into the airs again? I mean, how careful does that have to be?
Ms. Zuma.
Thank you, Chair. Thank you, Senator. As Mark Abrahamson said earlier, really it's only that outer 1 inch or so that is really a problematic part of the tree. So that remaining wood inside there is all very viable for reuse.
Thank you.
Okay, Representative Scarba.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Mr. Chair. I have a couple of questions. I represent northeastern Minnesota. I was mayor of Ely, and we have a very aggressive tree program. Our problem is the trees are so old, the branches break and fall on cars. And so when we remove the tree, we replant the tree. And I like your comparison here, because when we replant trees in the boulevard, in public land, public trees, the homeowners water them. The homeowners care for them. They keep the deer away. They do all that. I mean, I know you have dollars set aside for that, but I'm just curious if you have any buy-in. As community members, you know, I think of some of our biggest problems, we don't work together, and maybe if a tree helps community members come together and say, let's all work to make this thing work so we have shade for our children. That's one of the other questions. And then your wood utilization market, is that being chipping yet? Or and if you could just explain a little better for me. Thank you.
Ms. Zuma.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Representative. Wisconsin, our friends next door, have an amazing urban wood utilization program where cities remove trees, they take it to a marshalling yard, and carpenters and artists come and grab the wood. So there are plenty of examples. The U.S. Forest Service is making many great resources available for states and cities to start to reuse this wood. Because we know that it is a climate response. We can't just cut down these trees that are doing all of this great work for us and not have a highest best use for it. So there is plenty of precedent for this kind of work.
Thank you. Mm-hmm. And Senator Hoffman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And it's so nice to be over here in the Senate, the state office building. Although these chairs are a lot more comfortable, you might have one missing here, Representative Hansen. But I am, Ms. Sumach, if you could, something hit me when you know, you look at the potato chip comment, but really what hit me was 1976. Can you reiterate or restate what the allocation was in 1976, just so I understand that?
Ms. Sumach.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Senator. Yes, I, you know, just recently read through this again because I wanted to make sure, and I'd be happy to share the article. It's from the Minnesota Historical Society about Dutch elm disease with the committees. But it was $22 million put forth by Governor Anderson in 1977. And that was to address Dutch elm disease because it was, as mentioned earlier, this is a community issue. This is something that we all need to have a kind of all hands on deck mentality around not only the removal, the treatment, but also that restoration of the tree canopy through maintenance efforts.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I think that answered the impact on that. It's like, okay, they did that. We made it a priority back then, and now we're sitting having this discussion about, you know, the issue of emerald ash borer. And, you know, granted, there's a bunch of these on school trust land. How do we take full advantage of the fact that we can clean up the environment and also maybe put some money into our school trust possibility? But I just wanted to hear that impact again about what we invested as a state to clean up the Dutch Elm piece in 77. So thank you for letting me ask that question.
Thank you, Senator Hoffman. And I'd like to thank the presenter. There's one more question. Representative Lee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Sorry I didn't raise my hand fast enough. So to our testifier, understanding just looking at the bullet point number two around sustainable funding to help with community forestry, understanding that under the Federal Infrastructure Investment and Jobs Act, this is over, I believe, $600 million for the Clean Water Revolving Fund, Drinking Water Revolving Fund. Similar to the question that I posed to the MPCA, have there been thoughts from local units of government to pursue the Clean Water Fund as a source for green infrastructure?
Mr. Johnson.
Mr. Chair, Representative, so you said Clean Water Fund. You meant the Clean Water Revolving Fund, Representative? Okay, because that would be very different. Clean Water Fund is the legacy funds, as you know, but some other people may not know the subtlety of those differences. The Clean Water Revolving Fund is the federal pot of money made available for work on wastewater infrastructure. There is also a Drinking Water Revolving Fund, which is available for low interest loans for drinking water side. For the wastewater side is the Clean Water Fund. The Drinking Water Revolving Fund is the drinking water side. Those are to subsidize low interest loans. So no, we have not had any cities looking for subsidized loans to do their forestry programs at this point. I don't know how applicable it would be. There are probably some of the new IIJA pots that could be considered for that, but we have seen more use of that for green infrastructure as part of a wastewater treatment facility or a drinking water facility where they're doing something on site there that's green infrastructure.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I would just like to add as a comment, you know, I would encourage you all to take a look at the federal Clean Water Drinking Revolving Fund. There is a memo out there specifically for green infrastructure, and it does not have to be related to wastewater treatment facilities. And so I would encourage all of us to dig deeper into that too as we look forward towards, you know, a funding source that will be available for local communities with tree planting. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. And one more question from Senator Wiesenberg.
Thank you, Chair. Hopefully this is just a quick question. I was wondering, do we have an urban ash tree database possibly, and do the residents in urban areas help watch the ash trees around their areas to help the state know if infestation is coming? Thank you.
Mr. Mecca, Mr. Johnson, there's two questions there, but see if you can make into one answer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Senator. I believe that would be an amazing question for the Department of Agriculture, because they are the ones keeping track of where the ash trees and the new fines are being recorded. If you head over to the MDA website, that EAB page has that location. Now, that would probably be the best spot.
Thank you.
Thank you. The testifiers are always available for questions from members after committee as well, right? So we have next up Rob Vanette, EAB Research from the University of Minnesota Invasive and Terrestrial Plants and Pest Center. Welcome to the committee, and if you could state your name for the record.
Well, good afternoon, Mr. Chair and members. My name is Dr. Rob Vanette, and I'm a research biologist with the U.S. Forest Service, and I'm also the director of the Minnesota Invasive Terrestrial Plants and Pest Center, which we affectionately call MITPIC for short, at the University of Minnesota. And I want to thank you all for the opportunity to provide a very brief report about past and ongoing research on emerald ash borer in the state. From the very beginning, this research has been highly collaborative, particularly between the university, the Forest Service, the Minnesota Department of Agriculture, the Department of Natural Resources, cities, and private landowners. It has also reaffirmed the University of Minnesota as a national leader in invasive species research. Today, I'd really like to focus my comments on three significant areas of study. So first, research to preserve the functioning of our abundant black ash forests in light of the threat posed by emerald ash borer, methods to better detect emerald ash borer on the landscape, and developing new or improved management options. So for context, I thought I would just quickly mention, though, that Minnesota researchers were part of the team who first estimated that EAB might cost the nation $25 billion in damages, but that efforts to slow the spread of emerald ash borer could reduce those costs by half. So Minnesota has more than 1 million ash trees, more than any other state. You've heard a few other speakers mention that today. The overwhelming majority of those trees are black ash. This species goes predominantly in lowland hardwood forests that are found in the northeastern part of Minnesota, often in waterlogged soils where few other tree species can grow. So U of M research has shown that black ash trees are a keystone species in these forests. They're critical for regulating water levels, mitigating floods, and providing unique habitat for wildlife. Black ash trees are also harvested to a limited extent by the forestry industry and are used by native tribes for basket making. Black ash is also highly susceptible to emerald ash borer. So the loss of black ash would likely transition these communities to ones dominated by shrubs, sedges, buckthorn, with simultaneous severe ecological, economic, and cultural impacts. So what's to be done? U of M research with the Forest Service has explored the option of underplanting trees that are resistant to emerald ash borer and can survive and grow in these very unique conditions. So maple, balsam poplar, hackberry, swamp white oak have all given very promising results. Disease-resistant American elms or Manchurian ash have also been explored as possibilities. The fundamental strategy that's being explored here is striving to keep black ash forests well-stocked with trees while recognizing that ash might become a minor component of these forests. It seems very important to remind everyone that emerald ash borer is not known to occur in our black ash forests yet, and perhaps that's because of a bit of good luck, or perhaps, as my own research suggests, is that these black ash forests may occur in parts of the state that are too cold for the insect. Now, where EAB does occur in Minnesota, U of M research has been very critical to support two common management responses: sanitation and biological control. So quickly removing and destroying infested ash trees slows the buildup of EAB by up to 60%, delaying the infestation of healthy trees. This approach is the primary management that most communities in Minnesota currently are using, but it must be implemented quickly, particularly in areas where we found new infestations to slow the spread of EAB across the state. Minnesota has also been an early adopter of biological control with tiny non-stinging wasps as part of a national effort led by the U.S. Department of Agriculture. Now, these wasps naturally regulate emerald ash borer in Asia, where both insects are native. After the USDA confirmed the safety of these wasps, the University of Minnesota worked very closely with the Minnesota Department of Agriculture and demonstrated that these insects would be able to survive our winters, particularly in southern Minnesota, and could distribute great distances to find new infestations of emerald ash borer once the wasps were fully established. Now, fortunately, emerald ash borer is not yet everywhere in Minnesota. Finding it early gives land managers more time and options to achieve desirable outcomes. Research at the university has demonstrated that woodpeckers are highly efficient at finding EAB at least 2 to 3 years before insects would begin to kill trees, and looking for signs of woodpecker activity is the preferred method for detecting new infestations. Other methods, such as purple prism traps or branch sampling, are also effective, but they can be very time-consuming and costly to implement. U of M research has also shown that a synthetic pheromone specific to emerald ash borer can be used with the prism traps to catch more EAB. The attractant works to about 90 feet. So lastly, I'd like to acknowledge some of the exciting results coming from recent ambitious research on emerald ash borer conducted through the Minnesota Invasive Terrestrial Plants and Pests Center. A particularly significant question has revolved around how to preserve large diameter ash trees in communities around Minnesota. Now, large diameter trees provide disproportionate benefits over smaller trees, especially for stormwater management, pollution reduction, and carbon sequestration. So MITPIC teams are exploring the use of non-neonicotinoid biorational insecticides to achieve a form of associational protection or herd immunity for large trees. In other words, can treating some trees protect nearby untreated trees? And the answer seems to be yes. And while we still have a few lingering questions, the ramifications of this research are huge for the cost, safety, and efficacy of the approach. Another research team funded by MITPIC has identified a forest of fungi associated with emerald ash borer. And now many of those fungi cause disease and rot in ash trees, but many others will infect and kill emerald ash borer itself. Now research has quickly progressed from discovering which fungi can kill eggs, larvae, or adults of this insect to the methods to deliver the fungus to the trees. The simplest approach involves spraying the tree with spores in a water suspension. But the team is also exploring an exciting alternative involving injecting the fungus into the tree where it can lay in wait for the arrival of emerald ash borer and kill the insect before it can infect another tree. A third team is working with virtual reality to help recreationists visualize the impacts of emerald ash borer and different management alternatives on a landscape. Early results show that recreationists clearly disapprove of management activities that make a site feel unnatural, a result that really highlights the complexity of managing forests for multiple uses. So in closing, I want to thank the numerous individuals who have made this research a success, especially Drs. Brian Akema, Bob Blanchett, Catherine Bushy, Bob Haight, Randy Kolka, Brian Palak, Matt Russell, Ingrid Schneider, Rob Slezak, Marcella Winmiller Campioni, and all of their students, staff, and collaborators. I also want to thank the Legislative Citizen Commission on Minnesota Resources, the Environment and Natural Resources Trust Fund, and you for your previous and hopefully future support for the Minnesota Invasive Terrestrial Plants and Pest Center. Thank you.
Thank you. Representative Jordan.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Dr. Vanette, for your testimony today. I am glad to hear that our black ash in northern Minnesota seem to be doing well. So is it only because of temperature? And if so, as climate change happens and Minnesota's climate models predict that Minnesota will be warmer and wetter, how would that impact the spread of EAB to those black ash stands?
Dr. Vanette.
Mr. Chair and Representative, cold is not the only thing that's keeping emerald ash borer out of these areas. These are generally unpopulated, relatively small communities, and so the volume of ash that's being moved around the state is relatively low compared to our higher density populations. So that's providing fewer opportunities for EAB to be moved into those areas. However, as our winters tend to warm, it's providing more and more opportunities for emerald ash borer to spread. And we know those stands are highly vulnerable. And should EAB arrive and be able to survive the winter, it would decimate those ash forests.
Representative Jordan.
Mr. Chair's fault. And Dr. Vinette, I don't expect you to have to know the answer to this, but as that happens, and I'm sure someone will find me, I worry about Minnesota's treaty obligations to our bands, as many of our indigenous bands retain the right to hunt, gather, and fish. And as you mentioned, black ash is an important species for gathering and for traditional crafts such as baskets. So I would hope that someone would contact me about how the spread of EAB would impact treaty rights for gathering and what Minnesota's obligation is to do so, and any other species that do rely on our ash. So I'm hoping someone can get in touch with me about that.
Dr. Vinette.
Mr. Chair and members, I want to be very cautious and not speak for tribes, because tribes have a very deep history with black ash, and it would really be inappropriate for me to speak on their behalf. I will just say that tribes that I've worked with are deeply concerned about this issue, for many of the reasons that you've raised, and many others.
Representative Finke.
Yes, thank you, Chair. Thank you for your presentation. Representative Jordan asked the question that I was going to ask about climate change affecting the research that you're doing in terms of keeping the EAB out of those forests. And I guess since that question has been answered, I will just note that one way we can avoid that is by planting a lot of trees to slow climate change.
Senator Wiesenberg.
Thank you, Chair. My question was towards the wasps. I know I've done some work with like purple loosestrife and the beetles, and their whole life cycle is just with purple loosestrife. So is this similar? The wasps are just affecting, or only, their life cycle is only with the emerald ash borer. So when the emerald ash borer is gone, the wasp would die. So we wouldn't have to worry about it interfering with any other native species.
Dr.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair. Senator, yes, that is correct. These are very specific to emerald ash borer, and without an emerald ash borer host, those wasp populations cannot sustain themselves.
Thank you.
Anyone else? And you're available for tours as well over at the terrestrial?
Happy to show you what we've got.
Next up, a presentation on wood waste from District Energy and Xcel Energy. You'd introduce yourself for the record.
Mr. Chair, I'm Kent Smith. I'm the CEO of District Energy St. Paul, and we are the owner of St. Paul Cogeneration and also Environmental Wood Supply. Thank you for the opportunity to update you about the issue of our emerald ash borer, the impact it's having on tree waste, and our role in managing it. The last time Minnesota faced such a widespread death of trees was in the 70s and 80s with Dutch elm disease, which we've heard about today. This is actually an aerial photo of the wood yard at Pig's Eye, about 5 miles from here, about 1979, 1980, covered many acres, and the trees were piled about 60 feet high. In the metro, wood waste from diseased trees were piled up in locations like this wood yard, and where the operators of the site reportedly, quote, found themselves inundated in acres and acres of elm debris, with more coming faster than they could have managed, unquote. It was reported that the piles were over 60 feet high. This photo, ironically, was saved by from a building that caught on fire as a fire spread at this wood yard, and this is the only known record of it. And this is that wood yard 9 years later, after much of that wood was open burned. One of the reasons for siting a combined heat and power plant at District Energy St. Paul in the 1990s was the response to the difficulty the region was having with managing wood waste. The St. Paul Cogeneration Plant was purposely designed to develop with private money to significantly solve this regional problem and use diseased trees and tree trimmings and so forth as renewable fuel source. It was modeled after similar other facilities, combined heat and power plants in Sweden that use tree waste as a fuel source to reduce dependence on fossil fuels and reduce carbon emissions. Operational since the spring of 2003, St. Paul Cogeneration uses approximately 250,000 tons of wood waste annually as its primary fuel source to generate 25 megawatts that goes to XL Energy and approximately 55 megawatts of thermal energy to District Energy St. Paul, which heats roughly 32 million square feet of building space in the downtown area, 200 buildings, including the Capitol Complex and all of the hospitals. Over the 20 years that St. Paul Cogeneration has been operational, it has become the go-to resource for the orderly management of the majority of the region's tree waste. This is a recent study from that was done on behalf of the Partnership on Waste and Energy for Hennepin, Ramsey, and Washington counties, and has estimated that we are currently managing approximately two-thirds of the region's wood waste. Tree removal and disposal of the resulting tree waste is a very complex system. Tree waste from cities, counties, agencies such as MnDOT, VA, Air National Guard, private landowners, and businesses comes to us in many different forms, from wood chips to raw brush and logs to mulch. It comes from tree trimming, storm damage, land clearing, and of course disease. Since 2013, we have processed tree waste from 170 Minnesota communities. Now, as I mentioned, we turn approximately 250,000 tons of tree waste annually into energy. And to give you a sense of how much material that is, if it was all in the form of wood chips and put on the semi-trucks, the largest semi-trailers that you could have and put on the road, it would fill approximately 11,500 semis every year. And if we were to line those up end-to-end from the state capitol along 994, it would reach Alexandria. While we work with many units of government, we serve mostly businesses, hundreds of them, in fact, and most of them are small businesses. In excess of 750 have used the wood yard at Pig's Eye to dispose of tree waste from public and private lands and have it processed into biomass energy. While most of them are located in the metro area, they actually go all over the state, and this is a location, just some concentration of the vendors, as well as the zip codes of the businesses that we have material brought to us from. That does not mean this is materials coming from Duluth. It just means that they're doing business in and around the metro area or in the region where we get wood waste from. Over the past 4 years, we have witnessed firsthand the growing impact of EAB is having on communities. Last year, we received so much tree waste, predominantly from EAB, that we had to shut down the wood yard that we've operated now for 19. This is 20th year. It's the first time we had to do that as a result of too much material. We had to shut it down for about 8 weeks because of a lack of space and safety concerns. Even with that shutdown, the volume of brush and logs that we managed last year equaled what we did in 2021, which was a record year. Since 2019, we have steadily seen the volumes of EAB increase, and the projections are that that's going to continue. This is from that same study showing just the amount of wood waste. The yellow line is the arc. We're handling about 250,000 tons every year. You'll see into the 2027 it reaches about double that capacity. It's been estimated that the spread of EAB will produce in excess of 1.7 million tons of tree waste in just the seven county metro area. Ground into wood chips again and fill about 76,000 semis. That would get to New Orleans. It's important to note that that is just tree waste from EAB. We were dealing with tree waste before EAB came along. Once EAB devastates our canopy, we're going to continue to have tree waste that needs to be managed. It is clear from everyone that has looked at the role that we play in the management of tree waste that we are critical infrastructure for the management of wood waste in this region. However, our ability to continue to provide this vital service is at risk. We will need an extension of the power purchase agreement we have with XL currently, and we will need a subsidy to manage, continue the management and processing of wood waste into biomass, reduce the cost of power. Thanks to the legislation passed and by the legislature in 2021, we were able to negotiate a new short-term power purchase agreement with XL that was subsequently approved by the PUC. That agreement runs this year and next year. The purpose was to provide a bridge so funding resources could be found to reduce the cost of power to Xcel. There's also a provision to extend the PPA beyond 2024, the contingent upon a submission of an electrification project that would use to displace natural gas used by district energy. There is an expectation at the PUC that any extension of a PPA beyond 2024 will include a price reduction. And that, frankly, is just not possible without a subsidy. And the situation is even more difficult due to inflation. Inflation we have experienced on parts, fuels, and consumables, such as chemical treatment, have upended the economics of the plant and made it very difficult. We do not see a path forward to continue to operate the facility and manage the volumes of tree waste we are handling and reduce the cost of electricity to Xcel without a subsidy for processing the wood waste. As a private company, we play a vital role in the management of wood waste in this region, but other than like other private power plants integral to the manage of solid waste streams, it does not receive a fuel subsidy. As a comparison, similar power plants in this state that generate electricity from refuse-derived fuel receive approximately $20 a ton as a fuel payment to lower the cost of the electricity generated so compete with other generation sources. It will take a similar fuel payment to sufficiently reduce the cost of our electricity sold to Xcel. From the discussions we have had with multiple stakeholders, if St. Paul Cogeneration discontinues operation, there is nothing to manage 250,000 tons of tree waste other than go back to what was being done before, and that is open burning. We greatly appreciate the legislative action in 2021 that allowed our facility to get a short-term PPA approved by the PUC. It was a short-term fix. We now need a longer-term solution. That's going to take partnership with you, partnership with many others in this room to make that happen. Thank you for the opportunity to provide this update to you.
Thank you. We are running close on time, so I'd like Mr. Evans and Mr. Krug to come forward and if they can condense their presentation. I know that members have caucus they need to go to, so if we can keep it brief. Introduce yourself for the record.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. My name is Rick Evans. I'm one of the lobbyists for Xcel Energy, so for all of you that are new faces that I've not met before, I look forward to working with you during your term in office with any issues, including the one that we're here talking about today. I'll try to make my comments very brief, and then I want Mr. Krug to make a few comments. Very quickly, a little bit of a primer on the way public utilities work. We own power plants, as I'm sure most of you know, but we also purchase a great deal of power from people who own generation plants that we do not own, and we do that under, as Mr. Smith referred to, a power purchase agreement. So we just buy the electricity from those plants and deliver that electricity to our customers. It's important to understand that when we purchase that energy under a power purchase agreement, we do not run that through what we consider our energy rates. We actually run that through something called a fuel clause, and it's a dollar-for-dollar transfer from our customers. So we don't mark it up. We don't earn a profit on that money. But as we pay money to people like Mr. Smith and his company and other companies like that, that money just flows through. I'm not going to go into deeply, but we did provide you with our little primer book. We encourage you for all kinds of energy issues to take a look at that and learn a little bit about the unique structure of public utilities. It does refer to the fact that the fuel clause, this pass-through of these costs, is how we collect money from those customers. So how did we get into this business? Very brief, quick history. In 1994, legislation was passed that required Xcel Energy to develop a certain amount of biomass energy. It was sort of an experiment, a pilot project, to see if Minnesota could become somewhat more energy independent using fuel that we grow here in Minnesota. We signed a power purchase agreement with District Energy first in 1998. I think they started production in about 2000 or 2002, and the first power purchase agreement was a 20-year contract that ran through December of 2022. Biomass energy is very expensive energy, and as Mr. Smith mentioned, you know, there's been a lot of work that's being done to try to get that cost down because that's our customers essentially paying for that energy. We signed two other biomass contracts as a part of that mandate. That energy, frankly, was so expensive, we eventually just bought our way out of those contracts so that we didn't have to take the energy anymore. It was cheaper to buy out the contracts than it was to actually buy the biomass energy. In 2019, we started discussions with District Energy about an electrification project, and that resulted in the 2021 legislation, which Mr. Smith referred to. We signed an additional two-year power purchase agreement at a lower price, and then we've been working with them since then. I'm going to turn it over to Mr. Krug to talk a little bit about the, what we've done since that time.
Krug, a minute.
Yes, thank you. I'll be very brief. Al Krug with Xcel Energy. I'm the Vice President of State Regulatory Policy. Just very briefly, we are currently operating under the agreement that Mr. Smith referred to that we've negotiated that terminates at the end of 2024. We're currently in the process of working closely with District Energy on evaluating proposals for electrification, and at the same time we will negotiate a new purchase power agreement to go beyond 2024. That would be, both would be subject to review by the Public Utilities Commission, so we will make a filing sometime later this year, and I'm available for questions. Thank you.
Thank you, members. I know folks have got other obligations. Just in summary, I think both in the House and the Senate, we are going to have a lot of discussion on this as bills come forward. There is no one answer here. We've listened to this for now 15 years. We're not going to be able to make more baseball bats and get our way out of this. We're not going to be able to do, we're going to have to do many things, everything, some way of dealing with it. We've got trees coming down. I mean, every ash tree on my block is gone, and I can literally feel the difference with the heat on that, and that is happening in neighborhood after neighborhood, rural, suburban, urban, all over our state. So we can treat, we can do the biological, we can slow it down. The more we slow it down, the more opportunity we have to contain it, but we have to dispose of these trees somehow, and I don't want them burned in piles out over right across the border in Wisconsin, or some being hauled out to greater Minnesota and burned. We have to figure out some way of doing it, and the clock runs out in 2 years. So we've got to figure out some way of dealing with it, and I ask anybody here if they've got ideas on how we can do that, because it's a massive problem. Senator Hur, and I know you've got a couple members that might have questions.
Yeah, does any of our members have questions? I want to reserve this time, perhaps, you know, to introduce ourselves. Would that be okay? Or?
I think we've got leaders saying we have to be somewhere
to be
in 2 minutes.
Somewhere.
Or 2 minutes ago. So.
Okay. All right. Maybe I'll just introduce my ranking member. Next to me here is Senator McCune. And there is our minority ranking member, Senator Eichhorn. So, and the rest can get to know each other.
Work with each other. We can work with each other. So with that, thank you. We are adjourned.